All right, Alan and Caitlin and I are here to talk about destroying satellites. But before that, Alan's going to protect Android.
Android in the Chrome browser, the threat analysis group tag at Google has just updated some information about attacks that were executed against a number of political targets. And this was announced back at the end of 2021 by the citizens group at the University of Toronto. So this is not an entirely new information, but the company behind these attacks, Citrox, which is located in North Macedonia of all places, is a really big up and coming player in this cyber weapons space. They're pretty much on par with the NSO group. And so the threat analysis group talks about these various attacks and tools from Citrox and the zero days and end days that Citrox exploited in its tool set. And so they go into greater detail talking about the various CVEs and also recap the governments that used the Citrox package. And it's an interesting group of countries. It includes some of the countries that you might expect to do this kind of thing, like Egypt and Indonesia and Serbia, but also Spain and Greece. So this is a pretty big deal in terms of Citrox's capabilities. They managed to package together multiple zero days, and they chained those together with some end days also. And their tools apparently are quite usable by these governments and exploit. I think it was not only Chrome, but and Android, but I think also WhatsApp was in there somewhere. But at any rate, yeah, it's well worth the read. It's a nice deep dive into how this worked, how Citrox did this, and also how Google and Citizen Lab figured it out.
Yeah. I'm glad to hear about that. We had a bit about it before, but you know, this is the modern arms race, and we are the modern warriors, I guess. Anyway. Right, and Caitlin has got more joy about Elon Musk.
I do, as if Elon Musk couldn't get more entertaining. Yeah. Apparently, let me switch the article. China is looking at ways to destroy the Starlink satellites that are in orbit. And I found this very interesting from a socio-political, I guess also economic perspective. Let me switch back. Where these companies, you know, it was pushed for a long time that private businesses should get into space, right? And we're going to get them competing with the government and prices are going to go down and it'll just be win-win for everyone. Well, what's going on is that suddenly we have these private enterprises in one country that are flying over other countries that might be a little hostile towards the companies that, you know, the founders are from. And now there are military plans to take out these civilian-owned pieces of equipment. So China in particular was looking at Starlink, put up by Elon Musk and SpaceX, which is a constellation of low Earth orbiting satellites to bring high-speed internet to users in remote areas. And it's not entirely sure how they're planning on taking down Starlink, but China is concerned, or at least that's what one of their papers says, or one of their studies, I should say, says in the South China Morning Post, that they're worried that the US military will use the Starlink satellites as a backend for military data transfer. So China, and I'm assuming other countries, are looking at ways to take down Starlink's privately owned, you know, low Earth orbiting satellite constellation. And this brings up a lot of very interesting questions moving forward about how we handle civilians putting up, you know, communication satellites in space.
Military data transfer. I didn't understand that part. I thought they would not like it because it's a way for their citizens to bypass the Great Wall and get to the internet. What kind of military data do they think it's going to transfer that would matter?
Well, Let's see, it mentions this in the article. Let me switch back here so you can see what I'm referencing. Mm-hmm. One concern among scientists, and this is a quote, was that Starlink network could be used to vastly increase the data transmission speed of U.S. military vehicles like fighter jets. And you might be right, Sam. The big thing might not be that might be a red herring, because what they might be most afraid of is Starlink providing internet to citizens to get information that they don't want the citizens to have. Yeah. You could be absolutely right.
But I suppose it would help. They give you better internet signal to fighter jets. That makes sense, I guess.
Yep. So, we'll see how this plays out. But private companies, and I brought this up before on the podcast, are becoming embroiled in international politics,
right?
Which will be a very touchy and interesting set of circumstances moving forward. Let's just put it like
that. As everybody deploys these satellites, they of course fly over all these nations that may not like it.
Yep.
Yeah.
And it's also worth noting that Starlink has been crucial to Ukraine's defense in Russia's invasion. It seems, although this is more speculation than confirmed, that the holdouts, the Ukrainian military holdouts in the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol that was besieged by Russian forces for over a month, they were cut off, totally cut off. However, they had at least one Starlink dish there inside the plant. And so they were able to maintain communications despite the total blockade and being bombarded constantly by Russian artillery and rockets. So it's proven to be a very, very effective tool on the battlefield and apparently crucial to Ukraine's defense. And they've deployed hundreds, if not thousands, of Starlink satellites to the both to civilians and to military forces on the battlefield.
Yeah, the Starlink receivers. And now that you mentioned, I think this is a really positive sign. You can't hide anything. Like, I keep seeing reports from Navalny, even though he's in prison, you know, shutting somebody up is becoming next to impossible, which I think is a very good thing to help end these oppressive regimes.
Yeah, especially as the technology improves, and maybe we can even see smaller satellite dishes in the future. Starlink's already on their second version of a satellite dish that is smaller than the first version. So, as the technology improves, it may become more and more difficult for governments to actually not only intercept the signals, but also to just locate the dishes themselves.
Yeah, and to be fair, this is what Elon Musk said, and it's also what the early internet pioneers said, you know, if everybody just had free speech, it would bring about a glorious utopia of peace and joy. And, you know, to some extent, there's some truth in that. All right, well, I got some stuff that I saw in politics that I thought was interesting. Biden campaigned and ran on a platform of making Saudi Arabia a pariah nation and accusing the Prince of Saudi Arabia of this murder of Kamal Khashoggi, although he denies it, and he didn't provide any evidence to prove it. And so he made him into our enemy, but now he needs them, and he's trying to be nice to them, and they won't even pick up the phone. The United States is trying to put more sanctions on North Korea, but our allies are not going along with it in the UN, feeling like we've done enough there. And there's an interesting article here in the same vein, pushing back on Ann Applebaum, who is a big favorite. I hear her all the time in the liberal media. She's very much a hawk against Russia and says we have to utterly crush Russia. We have to end all their grand ambitions. And he's saying, you know, this is not the thing to do. This article is by Andrew Latham in The Hill. And he says, this is how we got in trouble with World War I. I'm not sure he goes to World War I. That's what the articles I've read have said. World War II was caused by crushing people too much in World War I. And the current climate makes me think of what led to World War I. Everybody's just in the mood to fight. All the nations are just angry and wanting to invade each other for no enormously good reason. It's just sort of waiting for a spark to light the tinderbox. And I think I was talking last time, there's people that say we really need to end this thing in Ukraine because it really could spiral out of control and ignite a much larger war. And, you know, I think crushing Russia utterly is a very unwise move. not likely to lead to better security, and not practical. And the same with crushing North Korea. And I see again America doing the same thing, uniting our enemies by making a lot of enemies. We push our enemies together, like Russia and China. It would be far better to divide our enemies and to make realistic plans. Anyway, inside this country, we have a similar issue now. After the latest ridiculous mass shooting, we've got a battle over gun control. And of course, it would be nice to get rid of the guns. Obviously, people shooting up the schools is terrible, and not everybody should have these ridiculous assault rifles. But how do we get there? And so now the Democrats are pushing gun control, and the Republicans are saying that would do nothing. And so it brought up the issue, how effective is gun control? Especially from a security professional point of view, you have a control, then you measure how effective it is. And it's not that simple. Biden says the assault weapon ban lowered the number of shootings by 3, but the evidence is not really that clear. And I see a lot of angry Democrats that say the Republicans are just immoral and they need to change their mind. And there's an interesting article here in the BBC from 2018 about a Republican who did change his mind and push for gun control. And of course, immediately his popularity went from 80% down to 5%, and he's gone. So if you ask a Republican to support gun control, you might as well ask them to just retire from politics completely, just like the ones that resisted Donald Trump and are now being driven out of the party. It is a fact that you cannot just impose this in a hurry. And last one in this article, Financial Times put out an article talking about the effectiveness of shooting. And they have a chart that makes it look like when the assault weapons ban ended, suddenly the shootings went way up. But they also changed the criteria of when they put things on the chart around that time. So there's a lot more dots. So, you know, it's this, I hear people push on both sides here. And it's certainly, there's a whole lot of things you'd like to get rid of, like drug addiction, prostitution, abortion, and people shooting each other with guns. And that's nice. But saying that passing a law is stopping it is another statement. And that's a whole lot less clear.
So I'm going to make a statement that will certainly not be controversial at all. Mm-hmm. Why would someone want to get rid of abortion?
Oh, well, I think a lot of people like to get rid of abortion.
Not everyone is keen on abortion being gone. It's not one of those things like guns, like we would all be glad if no one shot each other anymore. There are a lot of people who are very happy to get abortions and very much are pro-abortion. So,
well, I think abortions and guns are frequently the best way to cope with an unfortunate situation, but most of us would rather never arise in a situation where either of these things are needed.
There's this narrative that abortion is always traumatic and that it is an unfortunate reality. But that's not every person's, or mostly women's experience with abortion. For some women, getting an abortion is like a very traumatic and personal, you know, thing that happened, and it was in response to a very unfortunate situation.
Yeah.
For other women, it was a Tuesday. I kind of want to move away from that narrative, especially with mm-hmm. Roe v. Wade being overturned, that abortion is this bad thing, that it's just like a necessary evil. That's not the case at all. It's a much more nuanced topic, and I know I've probably upset a lot of our viewers, but I do want to just, you know, move away from that narrative.
Well, I don't imagine you'll upset our viewers with that position, but I should mention that a lot of people have this deep emotional attachment to their guns too. But anyway, and taking away their gun is like unthinkable, ruining their lives, which is what all the Republicans find out as soon as they dare breathe a word in that direction. Anyway, in the same vein, let's hear about conspiracy beliefs from Alan. I think that's a big issue.
Yeah, I keep coming back to this again and again on this podcast. And this time I found a really nifty survey, or excuse me, not a survey, but a study from a set of German researchers. And the title of the study is, Can Conspiracy Beliefs Be Beneficial? Longitudinal linkages between conspiracy beliefs, anxiety, uncertainty aversion, and existential threat. And it's a valid question. You know, why do some people gravitate to conspiracy theories, because conspiracy theories obviously are so grim and dark and sinister usually, So if people are embracing them, maybe they're doing that because it makes them feel better. So what the study authors did was conduct two longitudinal studies, the first with 400 participants, the second with 1,000 participants, all in Germany. So this is a different political context, it must be noted, political and cultural and societal. And what they found was, well, let me get to that in a minute, but what they did was in the first study, they examined people based on more general conspiracy theory susceptibility. And apparently there's a set of questions that's kind of a standard for this. And then in the second survey conducted during the coronavirus, early days of the coronavirus pandemic, they asked questions that were specific to the pandemic, to the coronavirus, and some conspiracy theories relating to coronavirus. Then they also asked these participants questions relating to their anxiety and their aversion to uncertainty, and also their existential angst, shall we say. And again, they applied what are apparently standard questionnaires in psychology or psychology studies to measure these things. And in conclusion, they found that believing in conspiracy beliefs are not beneficial, that in fact, they belief in these increase people's anxiety and their feeling of existential threat. So, and pretty strongly at that. So it does appear that believing in conspiracy theories is not going to make you feel any better. So you might as well not believe in them in the first place, especially seeing as they're not true.
Well, you know, I read an article where a New York Times person interviewed a whole bunch of QAnon members and said that QAnon seemed to make people feel happy and better, just like any other religion. So,
yeah, and that's why I pointed out that this is a German study in the German context.
Yeah.
And I have to also say that the first study, the smaller one involving only 400 participants, used this apparently standard conspiracy mentality questionnaire, which is only five questions. And I have to say that reading these questions myself, I have to wonder if I don't score very high on this conspiracy mentality. Because, well, there are real conspiracies out there. Not all conspiracies are fake. There are real conspiracies, and then there are conspiracy theories.
You're not paranoid if they're really out to get you.
Well, I mean, not that people are out to get me, but that there are conspiracies and that some of them are very large. For example, I'll just read to you one of the questions from this conspiracy mentality questionnaire. The first question is, I think that many very important things happen in the world, which the public is never informed about. Well, I think that's definitely true. There are many very important things that happen.
Yeah, I'm not so sure, but it could be.
Yeah, or at least they're underreported and possibly even suppressed to some degree.
Well, I think we try to keep secrets, and I think the ability to keep secrets has gone down a whole lot lately.
Yes, that's true. And there are definitely valid reasons for governments and politicians to keep secrets.
Yeah.
From the public. But
I think this is very interesting. I often think about the effect of religion on human life. And one case that amuses me is Tom Cruise, who is like the head of Scientology, or at least he was. So he's in like one of the craziest, most reviled, hated cults, and it seems to be working fine for him. He's more star than ever. He seems healthy. He seems happy. So, you know, it seems to be the case that many people thrive on religion, and it doesn't matter how messed up the religion is.
Yeah. And you know, individual experiences may vary.
Yeah.
So it's entirely possible that the most animated QAnon believers go to rallies and they really do feel better because it's a major social experience for them.
Yes. And Hannah Arendt wrote about this. I just heard about it recently. I didn't know it went all that far back, but she said the problem in modern society is the people are lonely. They don't have a group. And so joining some kind of church gives you a group.
Yes. Although previously on this podcast, I talked about another study that found that people who believe in conspiracy theories or fringe political ideas are not necessarily more socially isolated. Especially nowadays that formerly fringe political ideas have become very much mainstream, especially in the Republican Party.
Yes, and I think that's again why a lot of liberals that expect the Republicans to knock off the nonsense don't realize that if they were to say, you know, knock off the standard Republican positions like the election was rigged and we all need more guns, they would have to like be reviled by their family and friends and cast out of their church, like what happened to Adam Kinzinger. I mean, his own family turned against him when he refused to back the big lie. So you're asking really a lot for those
right.
people
to it take seems what seem like reasonable position.
Yeah.
Sorry, go ahead.
That's all right. I'm done.
It seems that at a certain point, a conspiracy theory gains enough momentum that it crosses some imaginary boundary from fringe to mainstream. And at that point, whatever psychological underpinnings may have motivated it, animated it in the early days, now no longer apply.
Well, you know, I was horrified many years ago to see in the DSM-3 that if you do not adopt the standard religious beliefs of your community, that is considered a sign of mental illness. There's something wrong with you that you won't conform to what most of the people around you believe. But that reflected this belief that, you know, accepting the standard religion of your tribe is considered a sign of health and stability, which is probably true. Yes. Rebelling against it will certainly lead to problems.
Yeah, and if you are in a community that's not diverse and that's very ideologically consistent, then I would imagine it's all but impossible for you to think outside the box, so to speak.
Yeah. All right.
Right. And one other thing is that not all conspiracies are doom and gloom. And, you know, sometimes it's about just having that hidden knowledge. In fact, this week I had a friend send me videos about this new discovery that was going to change the world. And it's something called Electric Universe. And I saw about like 3 minutes of this thing. And I was like, this is pseudoscience conspiracy junk. But nowhere in it was, you know, bad people trying to take over the world. It was just an alternative theory to the universe that we know of, that no one else knows. You know, you're in the secret. You know? And, you know, so sometimes conspiracy theories are more benign than others.
Yeah, there's a teacher in the art department at the college that was wearing this strange metal medallion. And I asked her what it was. She said, oh, you're in science. You'll know about this. This is my special medallion to repel the radio waves that are attacking my brain from all the cell towers. Everybody knows about that, right?
Exactly. Yeah. So
that's a big one.
I mean, yeah. I mean, there's sometimes, yeah, you have, I think 5G is a little more malicious. The idea that the 5G cell towers are going to hurt people. But like I said, with the Electric Universe, it was just pseudoscientific bunk, like Deepak Chopra. Like it's just, you know.
Oh my, Deepak Chopra. Next, you're going to pick on Dr. Oz. Anyway.
I would never.
There's something very appealing about obscure knowledge, at least for me. And that's one of the main attractions of hacking to me, is that you have this arcane power over this mystery box. And there are very, very few opportunities in life where you have that kind of power, where one person can potentially change the course of history, which has happened thanks to hacking.
You can be a supervillain and destroy the world.
Well, you can be a supervillain, or you can be a super virtuous person, a hero. Yes. And so I think it is an appealing mentality to a lot of people out there, is that, you know, I can possess this knowledge, or I can possess this power. Unfortunately, some people channel it in just nonsensical and frankly idiotic ways.
Yeah, I think it's the modern wizardry or witchcraft. We have these magic spells that can do amazing things.
Yeah.
All right. And Caitlin has got the food supply.
Oh, unfortunately, yes. I have the food supply. So the BBC has an article by Claire Marshall and Malcolm Pryor talking about how hackers may sort of destroy our food supply, which is wonderful to hear, of course. So what's going on? Well, a lot of our food supply is automated, not just in the factories after it's been harvested, but before as well. So you have things like John Deere equipment that runs on highly sophisticated software, as well as other types of equipment like crop sprayers and drones and harvesters that run on, you know, sophisticated AI and algorithms that could totally be hacked. It's like the IoT of, you know, farming. Yep. And so there was a new report by the University of Cambridge talking about how all these things are highly vulnerable. And the UK government and the FBI said, you know, they're, you know, the threat against our food supply is actually growing. So, you know, people are very worried about things like attacks on our power grid, attack on critical infrastructure. Well, food supply is also very critical infrastructure as well, and something that's largely been overlooked and controlled almost entirely by private corporations who have every reason to prioritize profit over, you know, stability. And especially with a just-in-time model for food delivery that we use, any disruption could cause things like, oh, I don't know, just off the top of my head, baby formula to suddenly be inaccessible towards mothers. So it's, you know, it's a problem that we need to address. So.
Yeah, I think we've got a poor risk analysis with this just-in-time stuff. They needed to consider supply chain risks more.
Yeah, they absolutely do. The problem is that in the way that we've set it up, we prioritize getting things out cheaply and affordably at all costs. As long as it adheres to like FDA, you know, approval and stuff like that, doesn't kill the consumer. We want to be able to make the prices as low as possible, which seems like a good idea, especially if you come from an economics capitalist background. You know, people don't want to pay $20 for a loaf of bread. And I'm not saying that would ever happen, but
yeah,
you know, people, you know, like cheap prices. And the way you get the cheap prices is that you just go, you get rid of the middleman as much as possible. So you go straight from the factory to the store shelves, and then people can pick it up and use it. But if there's any sort of change in demand, or if there's any sort of change in the supply structure, then suddenly you have no baby formula, suddenly you're out of toilet paper, or suddenly you're out of radio equipment and computers, all the things that we've experienced recently due to these supply chains that it's just everything is so fragile. Mm-hmm. And that makes it very vulnerable to attack. So up to this point, all of our supply chain issues have been largely natural caused. So the baby formula had to do with contamination because one company controlled all the baby formula. The toilet paper during the pandemic was due to a rise in demand at the beginning of the pandemic when everyone was going to be working from home. And the most important thing you have at home is toilet paper, obviously. And you know, things like a lot of the chip shortages have had to do with things like factories catching on fire. I mean, just by accident. So, you know, up to this point, it's been all sort of natural. I'm not going to say completely natural, but, you know, it's been accidental causes of the supply chain issues, with the exception of oil and some of the stuff we throw on Russia and stuff like that. But if a menacing attacker wanted to weaponize supply chain issues, they could easily hack into things like large farming equipment. And I'm sure what's really scary is that you have large corporations that have large control over a lot of the farming. So you have like one company, for example, like Monsanto. We all know like Monsanto controls all the crops to some level, or the vast majority of crops to some level. And those companies are going to standardize their equipment. And if there's a bug in a John Deere crop harvesting machine and the farmers can't harvest their crops, you could artificially create a supply chain issue where people are not going to have food on the shelves. So,
yep. And that clearly could be a wise military move, maybe.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Well, I've got this tiny robot that I thought was fun. And let me see if I can figure out how to share my screen. There we go. So this is a penny, and on the penny, this little tiny robot is crawling. It is really small, smaller than a flea, and it is incredibly simple. It has, all it is a piece of flat plastic, which was then bent into this shape of a crab, and you power it by shining a laser on it, and then it walks around. So it doesn't have any internal circuitry at all, just this photo sensor. And I thought this is very interesting, you know, in the spirit of the impossible journey. You know, there's all these stories about these microscopic robots. You could have these microscopic things going through your body, killing the cancer cells. Or one I've seen before, you could make a microscopic mosquito and fly in and inject poison in somebody to kill them and stuff. You know, there'd be a lot of things you could do with these microscopic robots, and we're getting closer to them. Anyway.
Nanobots.
Yeah, well, this is more like microbots. But yeah, we're getting there. You know, another science fiction staple is intelligent dust, you know, where you just blow this dust in the air and control these little things and they can do things.
Even better, programmable matter.
Well, sure. Yeah, that's right.
So and gray goo. Gray goo. Yep. Gray goo for the win.
Gray goo, okay.
Yes. Just for our viewers that don't know, gray goo is a science fiction staple of a material that has gone out of control and sort of like takes over and overwhelms whatever it touches. If you've ever watched like Stargate, there's the replicators that are just these like little machines that go and eat everything and then multiply. That's sort of like what gray goo is.
Good. Another science fiction state.
It's a end of the world scenario.
Yeah. All right. And Alan has a humble bumble.
Yeah, another notable humble bundle, this time from PACT. It's a bundle of 24 books on cybersecurity and cyber warfare. And I mean, not to sound too promotional here, but it does look like a nice bundle. There are a number of really good, interesting titles that have been published only in the past year or two, like Antivirus Bypass Techniques and Threat Hunting with Elastic Stack and Practical Hardware Pen Testing. Some of these have appeared in previous Humble Bundles from PACT, but I actually went through and checked. A number of these are new and have not been offered previously. And most notably, it includes Adversarial Tradecraft in Cybersecurity by Dan Borges, mm-hmm. who's appeared on this podcast. So that's a good book. I haven't read it properly, but it's a good book. Folks,
so how much does it cost? How much?
$18.
$18 for 24 books.
For 24 books, that's right. Or you can pay less and get fewer books if you prefer.
Oh, sounds like a good deal.
It is. And of course, if you are a CCSF student, you do have access to all these books for free through the CCSF Library O'Reilly catalog. So right. You can just read these in your browsers. But, and also the San Francisco Public Library also offers free access to this O'Reilly catalog to library cardholders. But if you aren't a CCSF student, and if you do want to own these books for yourself, it's a very good value, I think. And a lot of these titles look very promising.
Oh, good. All right. And Caitlin has got The Orbital Debris.
I do. More Orbital Debris. We've talked about this before, but it's still a big issue. Ars Technica has an article written by Eric Berger. Once again, our friend Eric Berger, who's we've featured on this podcast many times before, his articles, I should say. Eric, unfortunately, has not come on yet, although we should probably ask. And yeah, so Earth's orbital debris problem is growing, and there's no clear answer. And that's sort of the gist of this article. Like, you have all this space junk starting from like the 1960s, even before the 1960s, where all these nations put stuff into space and they're still there. And they say that we have tens of thousands of pieces of debris that are 10 centimeters or larger. And then there could be millions of pieces of debris that are smaller than that. All going around the Earth faster than bullets. And if they hit another object, it could very likely take it out or cause more debris. And so the question is, who's responsible? who is responsible for cleaning this up? And the problem is that all these satellites are sort of in international areas where no one country has like sovereign domain over space. And so you can't just set a law saying that, hey, if you're going to put something up, you need to, you know, take it down and all this stuff, because how are you going to enforce it, right? If North Korea wants to put up 1,000 satellites, who's going to stop them? I mean, certainly the United States could fire lasers at their equipment, blow it up, start a huge international incident. I'm not saying this is a good idea, but they could. And then you've just created a bunch more debris,
right?
The lasers.
You know? If China shoots down the Starlink, it would do that too.
Exactly. So one of the things that modern satellites, especially the Starlink constellation, has been good about is being in a very low Earth orbit. So the atmosphere will eventually drag them down after a few years. But of course, a lot of the debris in space was put up in a simpler time, when you just cared about getting your stuff in space. And if your booster is now orbiting the Earth for, you know, eternity, you know, that's just the way it is, you know. And people didn't worry about things coming back down. And now a lot of our critical infrastructure is, of course, in orbit. And so there's policy and economic challenges, like who's responsible, who pays, how much do they pay, and how do we hold people accountable if they do put up a tremendous amount of trash into space? And so normally that would sort of fall, I think, under the United Nations Committee of like Peaceful Uses of Outer Space. But, you know, that's just a, you know, if Russia or China doesn't agree, you know, with them, I mean, there's no, there's no way to enforce it. So, yeah, we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. All right. I've got a bit of physics. There's protons. You think of a proton as a fundamental particle, but it isn't, of course. Protons are made of three quarks or more, in fact. And so if you hit a proton with a beam to look to examine it, and you're at a relatively low energy, so you have a low spatial resolution, you'll see a single spherical blob. But if you use a higher energy and probe inside, you've got these three quarks. And if you go deeper, it's even got more. It's got gluons, and it has quark anti-quark pairs that jump out of the vacuum and go back. So you might find five or seven quarks in there. So anyway, these visualizations are pretty nice. And of course, since you at high energy, you're doing this at relativistic speed, it flattens like a pancake here. So this is the actual shape and internal structure that you're going to observe looking at a proton. And, you know, I thought these visualizations are quite interesting and quite helpful.
What I always found really interesting about the three quarks is, of course, the gluons hold them together so tight that the energy required to pull apart the gluons would actually create a new proton.
Right. You can never get a single quark out.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. It's pretty crazy. Anyway, there's one last thing I wanted to mention that affected me. There is a critical Zoom vulnerability, a 9.8. They can execute arbitrary code on your machine through Zoom, even when you're not doing anything, by sending you an XMPP message. And the Zoom now has auto update, which does not work. If you open your Zoom and check, it did it this morning, it'll tell you you're on version something 0.06 and 0.08 is available and it has not updated. You have to update it manually, despite the fact that they have something called automatic update. It doesn't work. So there's a cheerful fact. And I must say, this is true of all their automatic updates. It's true of Microsoft automatic updates. They frequently stop. Firefox automatic updates seem to actually work. But anyway, Zoom doesn't. Anyway, that's it for this one. And we will be back on Tuesday.